Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from National Public Data. You might be asking yourself, what's National Public Data? Well, that's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background checks. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description, again, to get 14 days free.
The element of asymmetry that I think the Super Hornet would bring if you added it to the Air Force inventory in terms of, okay, now the adversary has to account for me being able to land and operate off of any island anywhere. That just increases the places that they need to be able to hold at risk. It's a decision-making calculus problem, like get in the enemy Zeta loop, force them to account for more things in more places. So yeah, those are the big key points. And I think that if the Air Force, either the Guard or active duty, were able to energize this, I think you'd see a ton of interest from the pilot side. We've got to look at the retention problem we have right now. Like, not every problem is a stealth problem to solve. Yeah. Although it increasingly seems that is the mentality. But you still need platforms that can just carry a lot of stuff and be very versatile with it. And that's something that the Super Hornet gives you.
Tower Demise Pitches, release to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altera 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
My friend Rav Kerbal's at 354.
Sir, yeah, that's on.
Next, picture
610, 13,000,
and I'll give you some of that.
Driver on target.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for listening in. As always, thanks for watching. If you're over on YouTube, wherever you are, if you make sure you're following on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, that greatly helps the show out. Leaving a rating or review, if you get something out of this content, helps this show get shown to more people. So thanks for taking the time. If you're interested in There Are Was stories and some additional content that lives over on Patreon, there's links down below. My guest today is Patrick Burt Brown. He's an A-10 pilot. We're going to talk about an article he wrote over on the War Zone a few months back, talking about the F-18 being a replacement for the A-10 and why he thinks that would be a viable option. This is not representing the United States Air Force nor the DOD and their opinions. This is just our opinions as we have a discussion, which I think is good to have around these type of topics because there's a lot of things going on. These are very expensive programs that are bouncing back and forth. And Burt breaks down some of the reasons why the F-18 might be a viable option to replace the A-10 and why we want to capture that knowledge and skill set that lives inside the A-10 community and not just let it fade away as the A-10 is divested from the United States Air Force. So with all that being said, let's jump into the podcast with Burt. Burt, thanks for joining me on the podcast, man.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, so this one is going to be a little bit different. Like to have you back on the podcast. We'll talk more of your flying career in kind of the traditional sense. But today I wanted to dig into an article that you wrote. So I guess a couple caveats, and I know you'll probably back me up on this, but one, this is not the official stance of the DOD, the Air Force, or anything like that. You just wrote an article, and I think it's a good discussion point. It's also one of those things, too, where it's amazing. We had this conversation pop up, and now I'm blanking on which podcast because it hasn't aired yet. But about the A-10 versus the F-35 and how much press it got. And, you know, if you dug back into the development of the F-16, the F-15, a lot of these documents and reports were available to the public, but you had to physically go to some location. Like, there's no way of doing it. Now you can find it on the internet. All that being said is it generates a lot of conversations. It pops up in the blogs and the aviation geeks and stuff like that. And this is really just I think if it's fair to say, your opinion and a way to have a discussion about the A-10, what is happening with the A-10, a potential replacement for the A-10, and what that might look like. And you're not just going around bashing what our current inventory has. All right. Yeah. That's a butchered introduction, but I think it's important just to kind of put it. We're having a discussion today. So, Bert, I'll hand it over to you if you just kind of give me a broad brush of who you are and a little bit of your background.
Yeah, sure. Commissioned in 2010. Started flying the A-10 in 2013, and then but for a couple of years in Europe, doing some joint staff stuff. I have been flying the Hog the whole time. I've been to all the active duty bases in the A-10. Did my patch assignment in Korea, and then came back to the weapons school, taught the JFAC A course for a year, and then went to Europe. I was in Belgium. I came back in 22, summer of 22, and then I've been back at the weapons school, back at Nellis, I'll say. I fly with the weapons school, fly with another unit at Nellis as well, but A-10, and then got future plans probably to TX to something else. We think the A-10 will probably go away in 2026 from Nellis, so at that point. Right now, if nothing changes, if I can't convince the DOD to buy Super Hornets for the Air Force, then it'll probably be the F-35. So, yeah, things are good. I'm going to the reserves here in the summer as a full-time guy and, you know, navigating that path and looking at airline options and things like everybody else is right now. So,
yeah, greener pastures coming your way. So. But for another conversation another day, you wrote an article, and I'll link this down below, that okay. came out on the War Zone. It's A-10's pilot compelling case for replacing Warthogs with the Super Hornet. So let's just begin there. Why do you think the Super Hornet would be a good replacement for the A-10, specifically versus the F-35 or the F-16, if it's even fair? But like, why the F-18 specifically?
I would love to see what we could do, A-10 guys, A-10 pilots, getting their hands on the Super Hornet. I think we could get into a lot of cool stuff with that. There are lots of reasons. I've been thinking about this idea for years. It really gained some traction when I brought it up. I was at ARC WebTAC talking to some guard guys, and I pitched it in the bar. You know, the classic bar pitch on the napkin, and guys really latched onto it. And I was like, well, I've been thinking about this for years. I've talked it over with a couple of closer friends, and I thought, you know, the only way this is going to get out there as a real idea is if we write about it. So why the Super Hornet? Austere field capability. Look at what Finland does with legacy Hornets taking off, landing on, you know, roads in Europe. I think we'd absolutely be doing that. There's some Boeing video of, you know, ski ramp launches for Super Hornet that they were trying to pitch to India. But bottom line is it brings a lot of capability. It's a twin-engine aircraft. I think the single seat version is the one that we would want, but I would take two seaters if I could get them for free. The Block 3 is definitely what we want. But twin engine aircraft, austere field capes, you can refuel off of a drogue tanker, which I think is actually a plus for the Pacific because of the options that affords you. One of the things I mentioned in the article is, you know, refueling and kind of combat pairing with HC-130s, you know, take the A-10 CSAR expertise and now put them in a CSAR force package with HC-130s, and you've got a built-in tanker for the Super Hornet at that point. I think that's a compelling use case, particularly low altitude and closer to the fight, where I don't expect the KC-46 or any other boom tanker to really be hanging out, just based on the threat level. And I'm really caging all of this around the Pacific. So then you get into weapons loadout. The Super Hornet's fitted to carry just about everything we have in the inventory. and it's one of the two platforms that's currently fielded to carry SDB2. So it's at the leading edge for weapons carriage capabilities. For A-10 pilots, you know, we would have to learn the air-to-air stuff, but it gives you a platform that you can do a little bit of everything in. It's got a big wing on it, so you can hang out in the cast bite, go a little slower when you need to, but use the speed when you need it as well. So I think it's just a great overall option. And then when you look at the joint side of the platform, all the other countries that have it, particularly in the Pacific, you've got a built-in supply chain all over the world. And again, foot stomp the Pacific with Australia flying them. You've got a built-in supply chain. You can base them out of really anywhere. And there's a lot of use cases for short field ops that have already been demoed by the Marine Corps using Legacy Hornets, trapping on short fields and then launching them out of short fields. That really, if you look at the Air Force inventory right now, there's really nothing that does that. You can land A-10s on dirt, but if you load them up heavy, it's tough to take them off in a lot of cases. So I think the Super Hornet could get around some of that as well. So that's just a broad strokes overview.
Yeah, fair enough. That kind of jumps into the agile combat employment, the basing. And I think, you know, obviously if you're focusing this conversation around the Pacific, a lot of that logic, especially like, you know, I thought about, it's like obviously the Viper, right? It can go fast. You got air to air. You can do escort. You can do close air support. You can have a great loadout. Same with F-15. Same with F-35, et cetera. The one thing I guess you really can't do is get down low and slow with a C-130 and get gas. It probably would not work out that well in a lot of those other platforms. So talk to me specifically about agile combat employment. Can you give me a broad brush overview of that? And then how, you know, again, you've alluded to a little bit, but a little bit more in detail of like how the F-18, I guess, fits into that model better than anything else, in your opinion.
Yeah, so agile combat employment, ACE, is kind of a hot topic right now. Think of it as, you know, you move around from base to base, you take off from one spot, you land somewhere else. You got distributed ops, kind of distributed weapons supply areas. Everything is functioning in a distributed fashion. The Super Hornet gives you some extra ability to operate in various locations because its ability to land on short fields, particularly if you install, you know, trap equipment on a short field environment. There are portable systems to do catapult launches from distributed locations that I think we could get into if, you know, if we wanted to. I think it's totally possible. But yeah, the short answer is look at the gear on the Super Hornet compared to assets that we have in the Air Force. You know, you don't have to flare when you land the thing. And that gives you some extra options for putting it into a short field. And then, like I said before, weapons inventory wise, you can put just about anything on it. And then you've got the air-to-air swing roll capability that it has inherent, plus a fantastic radar, a very small RCS. There's just a lot of positives, and it doesn't do everything better than everything else by any means. But if you look across the spectrum of capabilities we have now, I think it does a lot of things well and would give us some extra options that create asymmetry and, you know, a decision-making kind of blind spot for our adversaries. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm trying to think of like a counter argument here to play devil's advocate. But if you did like a Super Tucano, right, it's slow, obviously can't do air to refueling, can't go long distances. if you weren't talking, if you remove the Pacific out of the equation here, right? And we need a platform that can operate in austere locations and provide close air support. Why could you not do a Super Tucano? Why could you not do, I mean, even like a T-7 or a T-50 and upgrade those? Is there a counter? Yeah, what's the devil advocate say inside of you as you try to talk yourself out of this?
Yeah, so Super Tucano or any other AT-6 light attack kind of aircraft, I'm not a huge fan of. And the reason being centrally is you're a single engine prop with not a lot of ability to withstand any kind of combat damage whatsoever. So that kind of does it for me right there without even going into the limited weapons carriage capacity or anything else. The Super Tucano is a cool airplane in itself. And it makes sense for, South America, I think. It works really well for the things that are going on there. But for any sort of near peer fight, I think that it's a non-starter. The T-50, I think, could be a decent platform for some of this stuff, but I just don't see the Air Force ever buying it. That's probably less likely than them buying Super Hornets. But then the T-7, I think, then you get into the whole Boeing the conundrum of Boeing that is going on right now. So, the way I see it, Boeing is divesting the Super Hornet to pursue the Wedgetail and the T-7, which if I were king for a day, I would tell Boeing not to do that and please keep building Super Hornets. Because I'd like to have more Super Hornets, particularly when the production line is responsible for somewhere around 700 aircraft being built. And I acknowledge the need for a new trainer in the T-7, but I don't think it outweighs the combat capability importance that you get out of something like the Super Hornet. And then Wedgetail, I'm not even going to dive into that right now because it's a whole other topic. But again, I think the Super Hornet's way more important than those. So I just don't think that anything light attack, a single engine prop, you don't get the range, you don't get the weapons capability out of it, and it's certainly not as survivable as a Super Hornet. So that would be my answer to that one.
Okay, now talking to the Pacific, right? So I can definitely see the advantageous capabilities, the short field, the landing gear, being able to prang that thing on without having to flare, against some of the modular launch systems where you could take off heavyweight and get out of there. Do you think that's a capability we absolutely have to have? Or is this something like, all right, hey, we buy the risk in this one area. If you need close air support, you're going to get an F-35 or an F-16 or an F-15, a Strike Eagle that goes in there. We're obviously talking that, everyone's gonna be operating. If we're talking about this, it's gonna be an advanced threat environment, air threat and air to ground threat. So, is close air support even going to be a thing, or is it one of those things like we wish we could help, but, we can't survive in it?
There's like two pieces that I'll hit on there. One is the close air support side, which I think is not a critical piece of the argument for the Pacific fight necessarily. And to dive in that one a little more, I think the direction the Air Force is going, which, if you look at the F-35 doc statement, or just what they're responsible for, what they train to and what they don't, the F-35 is a great airplane for what it was designed to do. It's not great at everything. And the F-35 pilots that I work with every day will tell you this. They don't misrepresent what they are good at, but it is not close air support. So I think the F-35 has just been talking point wise sold to the American public as a replacement for the Viper, for the A-10. And in reality, it really isn't. So divesting our nation's capability to do close air support is analogous to saying we're never going to fight another ground war. And I think that that is an imprudent way forward. I think that, you know, unfortunately, the Army and the Marine Corps, the guys on the ground, will pay for that decision in blood. And it's just a question of when. So that's the close air support piece. Again, I don't think it pertains to the Pacific necessarily, but I do think China respects our ability to conduct close air support. And, you know, they're probably not mad that we're getting rid of the A-10. Not that we're going to go fight a land war in China. But, you know, again, it's about, do we really want to get rid of platforms that do a mission or a series of missions like CAS, CSAR, FAC-A, SCAR? You know, we focus on those mission sets. Do we really want to get rid of that altogether? I really don't think you do, and particularly when there is no real plan for anybody else picking up those missions. Historically, leadership has said the F-35 would pick them up, but as we know now from various articles and, you know, the fly-off report, and Dan Grazer's been putting out a lot of deep dives into the F-35 as it pertains to CAS, and they're just not trained to it. So that's sort of the close air support piece. Then the other thing you made me think of there was, you know, discussing the capabilities of the aircraft that we do have. You know, one of the things I hit on in the article is the F-15EX. And I think the EX is a great jet. I've talked to guys that have flown it, and they love it. The problem is we're only buying 104 of them as of right now. And I don't think that you make a real dent on anything with 104 jets. So I hope we end up buying way more of those, because I think it is a great platform. We got to buy them with the conformal fuel tanks, because that gives you the actual weapons carriage capacity that we need from the platform. But it gives you the ability to go high and fast and carry 20 AMRAAMs, and that's awesome. You know, and yeah, we don't have anything that does that. So I think the EX is a great jet. We need more of them. I talked to the director of the Air National Guard, General Woe, about the Super Hornet idea down at ARC-WEPTAC. And, you know, he said at one point, you know, it's not that I'm opposed to the Super Hornet, but I just want other things more. And yeah, respect that. Like the EX is a great jet. If A-10 pilots were given EX and told to go figure out how to do the current mission sets with that jet, I think that it would be possible. I just don't think that the Air Force is going to buy enough of them that it trickles down. And then organizationally, I don't think that the Air Force is worried about losing the corporate knowledge that exists within the A-10 community. And that's another theme of the article as well. As you know, as soon as the A-10 divests, you're going to lose that corporate knowledge that exists in the community. And I think that that is a bigger deal than people give it credit for, particularly those that are, you know, outside of the A-10 community. There is something to be said about focused mission sets. Look at the Eagle community and the Raptor. They are focused on one thing, and it makes them exceptional at that mission set. So then jumping over to the Viper. Obviously, the Viper is a great airplane. I wish that we were buying Block 70s, but we're not. And so, again, I shake my head and wonder, you know, why are we not buying the best version of the jet? I think if you put A-10 pilots in the Viper, which we're actually starting to do via the Guard, one of our units, Fort Wayne, just converted to Vipers, and I've got several friends that are now flying the Viper, and you know, they've got great things to say about the jet, but but they're still flying block 40s and 42s. And I think you get more capability, obviously, when you put in an ESA radar on it. And I know some of the test jets are getting retrofitted with the APG-83 now. And it brings a lot more combat capability. But again, I would love to have Block 70s with conformals and, you know, an ESA built in from day one. Why are we not buying those? I don't know. But the Viper production line is largely, you know, foreign military sales. So it's one of those things, like, it's above my pay grade. But again, if I were king for a day, I'd be all about buying more Block 70s. Since we're not, I'm focused on trying to make the case for keeping that Super Hornet line open, which is looking increasingly unlikely. In 2025, that line's going to close unless something changes and we're able to convince Boeing that keeping that line is important for our national defense. How do you make that case? Gosh, with everything they have going on, I don't know. Because they've got a lot of other issues on the civil side, obviously, with all the airline stuff coming out recently. And then they're being pulled in many different directions. They're competing for NGAD. And then they're, you know, the Air Force is messaging, please build the T-7, build the Wedgetail. And nobody's asking for more Super Hornets. Save for the last couple of years, the Navy has bought, you know, small batches. But I did see an article come out about, I forget how many airplanes. It was less than 10, but the Navy was trying to order more, and the price per unit had shot way up. And that's just, it's so unfortunate. And it's probably due to supply chain and long lead time parts that Boeing has already started to sort of turn off the spigot for those things. And it just makes it harder to sustain a production line.
Have you been to the production line out there?
I haven't been yet, but I do plan on going out in the next few months. I got an invite to go out there, and I'd love to go see it and put eyes on, you know, the ground floor of the operation.
I mean, it's fair to say Boeing's been on the struggle bus a little bit between the 737 MAX, the KC-46, now Air Force One. I don't know about I think T-7's had some delay. Everything's had delays, the fixed price contracts, they've lost a lot of money, so on and so forth. But one thing, again, I'm blanking on where I heard this, but in order to expand that production line, I think even for like the T-7 to like full production or what, like there's a square footage limitation. Like, so you have to pick one show pony because you need more square footage, like Lockheed moving the Viper plant to Greenville, South Carolina. They need more square footage for the F-35 production line. So here's a question for you. So I know the Air Force has gone through a bunch of changes or announcements of changes of how the whole structure is going to work. Like, I only read one article. I need to look at it more, right? But I think it's like the most, when it comes to organizational and admin structure wise of the Air Force, probably in the last 30, 40 years of how everything is going to be organized. I think it still needs funding, yada, yada, yada. But could the argument be made like, hey, all right, the A-10 mission set, like I think keeping that knowledge and that has been built over decades is vital. I would also agree with you. Like, I don't think it's fair to say maybe the Air Force doesn't care, but it definitely gets lost. Like, there's some dudes who recognize in leadership positions that, like, that's a gap. Like, how long does it take to create, you know, a 14-year, you know, A-10 patchwear? Like, it takes 14 years. And if he or she leaves, like, that knowledge is gone. Like, you can't just produce another one like that. So could you make the argument that, hey, you know, maybe the mission sets for the Navy and the Marine Corps, that's the solution to this? Now, I know this thing would be killed instantly on any kind of politics where you reorg it, but hey, they already have the jets. They have the capability. Is this something that, you know, as you pivot towards the Pacific, all right, we only have, we're buying more F-35s. We're focused on NGAD, and the Navy is focused on boats and landing in short fields and things like that.
So are you asking if we should concede fight the Navy and the Marines?
Yeah, like if you, because like, I mean, I think, you know, in a realistic thing is like, is there money to go around? We can get into that. But it's like, is that an alternative to kind of execute the game plan you're talking about? In the ideal world, you get a big check and you can buy your Super Hornets.
I don't think so. The Marine Corps is good at supporting the Marine Corps, you know, and they fight in their self-contained, you know, deployable units. They're very good at doing Marine Corps stuff. The Navy, at least for the, you know, the units that deploy on boats, they spend a lot of time training to landing on the carrier. And, you know, unfortunately, I think that it eats into the other stuff that they're able to train on. And talking with some Super Hornet guys recently, it sounds like the deployment pace is pretty significant as well in terms of workup times lasting, you know, upwards of a year before going on a rotation. I don't think that you can just say, hey, Navy, Marine Corps, you guys got this. And that makes me go back to the old Key West agreement. And, you know, where is the Army in all of this? Why are they not being louder about the A-10 going away? I've always heard the argument, hey, let's just, you know, Army, you buy the A-10, or SOCOM, you buy the A-10 and sustain it. And again, it's a money problem, and I don't think either of those will ever happen. The Army is increasingly focused on long-range fires. And everybody's getting more and more focused on space-based capabilities. So money is going to those two things, I think. But I don't think that you can just say Navy and Marine Corps, you guys own CAS. I don't think they – I know the Marine Corps will continue to train to it. I don't think that the Navy is thinking that way at all. And, you know – gotta wonder, like, how effective are carriers in the Pacific fight? I have my opinion, and I don't think that they're very effective at all based on the long-range weapons that China has. So, and obviously we know China is focused on denying the way that they have observed us fighting over the last 20 to 30 years. And one of those central premises is the use of carriers to project power. So if you can negate the ability for the carrier to get close, then you're taking away that entire strategy. So that's my answer to that one.
Yeah, fair enough. Why do you need boats to move planes around? Why do you need the Hornets to protect the boat? Like, you could just cancel all this. But no, I think that's, I want to ask you, right, to, again, round this out for, you know, why this be a viable option, why there's a need for it. And obviously the Navy and the Marine Corps, that the Marine Corps, like you said, it's like very insular, you know, everything is owned by the Marine Corps, Marine Air Sports, Marines. That's how it's always operated. And it's also a smaller component. So you would have to plus that up in some sense too, not saying that, hey, if you plus it up, I mean, maybe their doc statement changes and hey, you no longer can just be just Marine Corps. It has to be looking out a little broader. There's some political hurdles that would have to be overcome, which might be harder than buying and finding more money for Super Hornets.
Yeah.
So writing the article, you've always had this conversation with friends and leadership and kind of voiced it. What's been the overall feedback? Where does this thing live? I mean, is it kind of stopped inside the squadron bar? Has it gained breath outside the walls, or where are we at?
So, I would say overwhelmingly positive feedback, which was a bit surprising. I expected there to be more naysayers. But for the guys in the A10 community, I would say overwhelmingly positive feedback. People love the idea, and where they really love the idea is in the guard. I'll give you an example. Look at Selfridge right now. Recently announced that they're going to get KC-46s and lose their A-10s. So one of the cases I make for the Super Hornet in the article is, you know, give them to the guard, and now you've got a jet that not only can do all this stuff that we're talking about deployed, but it can also help you in the homeland defense mission. And, you know, where we're increasingly short on airplanes and, you know, we use a lot of old stuff to do that mission. So, you know, one way I think you can make up ground there is replace not only some of the A-10s, but also some of the legacy Vipers. You know, if we've got Block 30s that we can replace with Super Hornet, I think a lot of Block 30 Viper pilots would be all about it as well. You get a better radar. I mean, certainly much better than the legacy radar, right?
Yep.
It just gives you options. So you can still do all the deployed ops that we were already doing, but it affords you more options. So I think it makes a ton of sense for the guard, but I'm not sure that they will go for it because I think they're more focused on EX. But why not have both? And I think this gets back to another core kind of thing that I wanted to hit on in the article, which is we've got to preserve production capacity. Because if we divest all these production lines, they're gone forever. You know, we know that. Raptor, you know, we wanted 800 Raptors, and we ended up with a lot less. And once that line closed, it was gone, and there's no restarting it. So I look at the Super Hornet line like it is a, no kidding, national security imperative to keep production capacity alive. It's one of the most successful fighter programs, probably just behind the Viper in terms of numbers built. But gosh, just letting it go seems like a silly thing to do when we're, number one, looking at the numbers of fighters that we have and, you know, the timelines that are out in open source about, you know, China and Taiwan and possibilities there. And so we're kind of in this shallow point of overall fighter capacity, kind of at the worst time. And yeah, I think if you get rid of that production line, you're now down to just the F-35, the EX, and the Viper, which is currently largely, if not all, FMS. So, again, when you're talking F-35 delays, total production capacity and future buys of the EX, which is, again, at 104 right now, you're not looking at a lot of production capacity unless we made some major changes to how the Viper line is being allocated. In other words, we start throwing money to actually buy the Vipers that we're building new. So I probably went off on a tangent there, but
what's the print cost of a F-18 Super Hornet? Yeah.
So I did a lot of digging through budget documents as part of writing the article. Tyler from The Drive was awesome the whole time, and he told me, you know, go with flyaway cost because it's the only one that we can really compare among different aircraft. So you strip down a lot of the other costs associated, like the O&M, ops and maintenance money. And at least, yeah, I saw different numbers out there first off, depending on the source. But if you look at just Wiley cost, the super was somewhere around $75 million. And then if you look in the National Defense Authorization Act from the last couple of years, and you just divide total money being allocated for new jets divided by the number of aircraft, then it's more like in the ballpark of 83 is what I remember from the 2023 NDAA. So significantly cheaper than the unit costs for F-35, which is kind of an unknowable number, I think, based on how you do the math, because there's three different variants. There's a lot of foreign partners. And so I think there's a lot of question up in the air about, you know, how is this math actually being done? But you end up with somewhere around $100 billion if you just use the NDAA for the F-35A model. So significantly cheaper than the F-35. Granted, it's not LO, but I don't think every problem is a low observable problem to solve either. and then for the EX, I saw some pretty high unit cost numbers, but it is a new production line. So I think the high end was like up around 120 for the EX.
But it can carry 20 AMRAAMs. So, I mean,
but, you know. But it can carry 20 AMRAAMs. That's right.
I have no questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say all these things, you know, I mean, 80 to 120 million, I think is typically the numbers you see bounce around, but there's ambiguity in it. And there's lots of not fuzzy math, right? But there are a lot of variables and dynamics that go into figuring out how much these things actually cost. In fact, I do remember the first time I went to Nellis on a trip, and the F-35, two of them had just shown up to Nellis, and they're starting to figure them out, right? And they had painted the light poles outside along the flight line, and the contractor, all the overspray blew on the jets. So, yeah, at the time, it's like, it's Class A mishap and unknown, like how much this thing cost. And, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity there because, again, it's just a lot of variables go into it. I think to also, like, very simply summarize in my simple brain, you know, the argument making here is, I mean, it's a diversification of capabilities. There's no one golden BB here, but having the F-18 do some of this close air support and capture the knowledge and the skill set out of the A-10 community, you're retaining a skill set and also gaining a capability, such as launching a heavy jet out of an austere location that can also do air-to-air, do close air support, get gas going slow, whereas an F-16 or an F-35 can't do that. And we need an F-35 to do some very complex and dangerous, operate in dangerous environments that a Hornet and an F-16 most likely will not survive in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think specialization is a good thing. First off, I think the F-35 program has made some of the same mistakes that the F-4 program made back around Vietnam timeframe. One with the lack of an internal gun on two of the variants. And then just trying to make one aircraft do everything. I think probably we could have learned from history a little better than we did, but we're full commit now. And the reality is we need as many F-35s as we can get. Because the more of them there are, the better, because of how they talk to each other and the capabilities they bring. So we need a ton of them. But the program is immensely expensive. that causes its own issues, and there are some delays with it. So, you know, we're fighting those battles, but in the meantime, it is troubling to see a lack of focus on other ways to solve problems. And, you know, the constant argument we hear on the A10 side is, yeah, well, we're going to save so much money by getting rid of it. It's just a hard one to hard argument to come to grips with when there is just not any real attention being given to keeping the knowledge and the mentality alive. And I think you need, what's great about the A10 community is you've got people that learn to deal with the Army as the customer. And there's something to be said for understanding a little bit more in depth about Army speak, how the organization is run, how they use their assets, being able, like one thing we do at the WIC for A10 is go out and actually plan with Army folks out at Green Flag and you go talk to the brigade commanders and say, here's what we can offer you in this fight. And I think when we get rid of the community, all of that goes away. And, you know, what you're left with is you have a lot of A-10 pilots or former A-10 pilots that are now in the F-35. Some of them post squadron command at this point, wing command at this point. And that's a good thing. But they, you know, they bring the knowledge they have and they try and influence what they can. But at the end of the day, the F-35 pilots right now are not required to train to cast even a single sortie. So, yeah, what we're left with is we've got great people that have gone from the A-10 into the F-35, a lot of them weapons officers, and they've taken their knowledge and they've tried to share to the max extent. But organizationally, unless something changes, i.e., you get specific F-35 units that are directed to train to something other than the Night 1 China fight, we're still going to run into this problem. And again, I think ultimately what you see, if and when we get into the next fight where we need to go and hold territory, you've got to put guys on the ground to do that. And then once you've got them there, you got to protect them. And without dedicated assets that train to that mission set, we're going to relearn old lessons that are not going to be fun.
Yeah, I can see the argument. I'm curious. I was, you know, as we march forward, like anything, it's all priorities and where things lie if it gains traction. It's interesting, the F-15EX. I would be curious to have been sitting in the room when that decision was made, because that one kind of seemed like it popped up last minute. But there's probably no advocate for the Hornet. There's probably no advocate. I think the buying new Vipers, like, that was dead on arrival, right? Like, Lockheed is printing F-35s, and that's when it's $185 million and a new Block 70 is $79 million or $77 million, then okay. It's that you're going to go with the new shiny toy versus the shiny new toy fourth gen. But I'd be curious, like, what transpired and just how fast the F-15EX gained traction. And they said, hey, yeah, this is the solution to augment our fight and add more fighters into the picture for night one, night two, night three.
Yeah, that's a great question. I certainly don't know the answer. I think the EX briefs really well. I think the Strike Eagle, obviously proven platform, the Eagle, almost mythical legend of a jet, but the EX comes from the Strike Eagle, right? And I think it briefs really well because of the 20 AMRAAM hard hitter number. Yeah. And we don't have anything else that does that anywhere remotely close. Like the Super Hornet, you can go, 10 by 0, which is great, but it's 10 and it's not 20. I think, who knows if it, you know, how much of it was personality driven, former Strike Eagle pilots, who knows?
Right.
That there is some element of that to it. And then I also, would not shock me. I'm sure the conversation has happened before where people look at the Super Hornet option and they say, oh, that's a Navy airplane.
Yeah.
Instead of just thinking that that's a U.S. airplane, it is a Boeing aircraft. It is, a fantastic jet. It does a lot of things very well. It would make us more joint with the Navy. It would make us more joint with foreign partners. Again, the whole supply chain thing, I think, is a great reason to do it. You asked before if, like, what is the state of this idea and is there anything being done with it? Truth be told, I don't know, but there are some conversations at higher DoD levels happening around what to do with the Super Hornet platform, whether that be the E model, the F model, the Growler. The Air Force pretty much gave away its ability to do electronic attack as a mission set a long time ago. And the Growler has soaked up most of that work. So, one of the ideas we've kicked around is, hey, what about the Growler? If the Air Force were to get Growlers, we already send pilots to fly the Growler. There's an established pipeline to train Air Force pilots to fly the Growler. So in terms of getting qualified to fly the jet, I don't think that's a problem. We send Strike Eagle pilots commonly to go do exchange tours with the Navy and fly the Super Hornet. We got a couple of those guys that are floating around that are still current in both aircraft. Which is awesome. And they have great things to say about the jet. And I've spoken to them about this plan, that I lay out in the article, and they're all about it. So I don't know if the idea will catch, fire or not, but I do think if you ended up with Growlers in the Air Force, however that happens, then I think there's a better argument to be made about, well, now we've got the logistical supply chain more established on the Air Force side. So can we build on that and add ENF models to the mix? Certainly seems more likely to me when you've got some element of the logistics solved. Hopefully that happens. I don't know what the Navy's plans are for the Growlers, but I've always heard rumblings of, them not being wild about the units that are just land-based. So if you could get land-based Growler units transferred to the Air Force and get our foot in the door that way, I think there's more of a case to be made for ENF models.
Yeah, that's kind of the thought that pops through my mind, right, is doing things different. Everyone always talks about that, like the innovate or die. But a concept like, well, I mean, really, you should throw Growlers with Seed Squadrons, right? Units that are doing it, and they can operate out of the same base or training out of the same base, and then however you want to split them up for, ACE, okay, whatever. But, to have it in a different service, but then so tied to a mission set that is, primarily done by the Air Force, such as Seed, like why the differences? Now you go into political money, all sorts of things come down to it. And everyone has their little kingdoms and everyone has their little pocketbooks. And then everyone, if they give up an asset, they lose money, right? So that's a conversation for a different day. I would like to pat myself on the back. I've made no Strike Eagle jokes so far today and no Canopy Bow jokes today. But as we wrap up here, Bert, any other like big takeaways or points you'd like to make, you know, regarding the A-10 going away, you know, losing those capabilities, the thoughts of the F-18 being a viable replacement for it, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, just I'll hit the foot stomps, I guess. One, I think it's critical to preserve the corporate knowledge that the A-10 community has resident in it now. I think you only do that if you give the community another airplane, preferably the Super Hornet, but again, Block 70 Viper, why not? I think void of any of that happening, what you're going to see is more of what happened with Fort Wayne. You know, they lose their hogs, they get some version of Viper. In their case, I think they're flying 42s, and they try and keep it alive themselves, but it's a guard effort, and that's purely dependent on the personalities in that unit and how much they want to, you know, how much time they want to spend on it. In Fort Wayne's case, though, I think they're making a push to become, you know, the Viper cast center of excellence, so to speak. I think previously the Fort Worth Vipers, I've worked with them before, and they've always been of that mentality, like, we're going to be good at this. They've deployed a bunch. I mean, the deploy experience I had with them was in 2013 and 14, but they were there Block 30s and, you know, did very well. So I think it's a mentality thing, and you got to care about it. And that's what it comes down to. Void of any larger, you know, Air Force organizational change. Again, specialization of F-35 units being one of the ways to do it. Changing of doc statements, that kind of thing. So then the next point is production capacity. Look at the big picture. What jets are we still building? What gives us combat capability? Do we want to be left with fewer options in just the F-35, the EX, and Vipers that are built for other countries? I don't think so. And if you look at the backdrop that is the defense industrial base right now, you've got only a few vendors that even build jets now. And, you know, over time, the smaller companies have either been bought out or forced out. So we're left with what we got. And one of those right now is still the Super Hornet. And yeah, I hope that we're able to convince Boeing to keep that line open, maybe find another buyer, but, you know, we're running out of time. So, yeah, India isn't going to buy them from what it looks like. And from what I remember, that was the last big question mark for Boeing. It was like, can we get India to buy these? And if not, the line probably closes. Unfortunately, I know from talking to people at Boeing, they've already started moving bodies around. One of the guys I used to stay in touch with when I was writing the article has already been moved from the Super Hornet program to the EX. So I think the signs are all there. So yeah, you know, preserve the community mentality somehow, preserve production capacity. The concept of mass being important, like, I need numbers of things. And then the element of asymmetry that I think the Super Hornet would bring if you added it to the Air Force inventory, in terms of, okay, now the adversary has to account for me being able to land and operate off of any island anywhere. That just increases the places that they need to be able to hold at risk. It's a decision-making calculus problem, like get in the enemy Zuda loop, force them to account for more things in more places. Those are the big key points. And I think that if the Air Force, either the Guard or active duty, were able to energize this, I think you'd see a ton of interest from the pilot side. We've got to look at the retention problem we have right now. Not every problem is a stealth problem to solve.
Yeah.
Although it increasingly seems that is the mentality. But you still need platforms that can just carry a lot of stuff and be very versatile with it. And that's something that the Super Hornet gives you. It's not going to go as high and fast as the EX, but it has some advantages over the EX as well, like we've already alluded to.
Low and slow.
Yeah, I mean, low and slow. Everybody makes fun of the canted pylons on the wings that are very draggy. But, you know, if you're not going above the Mach, who cares? And any A-10 pilot would be glad to have the afterburners on those things. And I know we would be able to make good use of them. So,
perfect. Well, Bert, I appreciate you joining me. Again, this is just your opinion. We don't represent the DOD or the Air Force and all those things.
Yeah.
And there'd be some great like disclaimer I should just pay, you know, someone to do it. But there you go. I think that covers us.
Yeah, we'll pull the one straight out of the article, put it on there in text so nobody can come after us.
Right. They'd be really disappointed. Well, all right. Bert, again, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Look forward to having you back on, really talk more about your career and specifically. So we'll chat soon.
Yeah, appreciate it, Rand. Thanks.
Your online security has never been more important. Recently, hackers stole over 2.9 billion records from National Public Data. You might be asking yourself, what's National Public Data? Well, that's the service that private investigators, companies, and staffing services all use to do background checks. This information is now in the hands of hackers who say they're going to give away this information for free. I use a company called Aura to make sure that whenever my data pops up in places I don't want, I get notified immediately. They also go right to work trying to remove your information from data brokers, as well as they offer a whole host of other tools. And should the worst case happen, they offer up to $5 million in identity theft protection insurance. Protect yourself and your family today with Aura. You can use the link down below and get a 14-day free trial, and this will be enough time for Aura to go out there, scan the web, and see what information is out there that you really don't want. You can go to aura.com/afterburn or click the link down below in the description, again, to get 14 days free.